Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Where is she?
You seem to have a soft spot for that young lady. You can't afford to make yourself that vulnerable, not when you're out trying to save your country.
Why is it that you sneer every time you refer to this country? You've done pretty well here. I don't get it.
No, you wouldn't. You're one of the ardent believers, a good American. Oh, there are millions like you. People that plod along without asking questions. I hate to use the word stupid, but it seems to be the only one that applies. The great masses, the moron millions. Well, there are a few of us who are unwilling to just troop along. A few of us who are clever enough to see that there's much more to be done than just live small, complacent lives. A few of us in America who desire a more profitable type of government. When you think about it, Mr. Kane, the competence of totalitarian nations is much higher than ours. They get things done.
Yeah. They get things done. They bomb cities, sink ships, torture and murder so you and your friends can eat off of gold plate. It's a great philosophy.
I neither intend to be bombed nor sunk, Mr. Kane. That's why I'm leaving now. And if things don't go right for you, if we should win, then I'll come back. Perhaps I can get what I want then. Power. Yes. I want that as much as you want your comfort or your job or that girl. We all have different tastes, as you can see.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dan.
And I'm Tim.
So welcome back to 15 Minute Film Fanatics. In case you don't know how the show works, it's about two friends who watch films separately and then talk about them on the podcast for the first time. So today we're going to have our first conversation ever, Tim, about what movie?
Saboteur.
Saboteur, 1942, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, with the screenplay by Peter Viertel, Joan Harrison, and Dorothy Parker, brought in to brush up some of the dialogue. So in part one, we always talk about our overall take on the movie. Tim and I have not had word one about this yet, but since it was my pick, and I asked Tim to watch it for the show or rewatch it, he gets to go first. So Tim, overall, watching Saboteur again, what's your take?
I looked at the production. It was, I guess, actual production was from December of 41 to February of 42. I actually, for reasons that we will get into later, I think this whole script may have been written just in the period from December 7th, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, until December 10th, when Germany declared war. I think it had to have been written just in that those 3 days, and then they had script lock and shot him. But you know, that being said, it's probably in some ways a watershed Hitchcock movie, because even more than Rebecca, it proves sort of Hitchcock's main, you know, ethos, which is nothing needs to make sense. It just has to have an emotional punch. And that's what this movie does, you know, famously ending with the Statue of Liberty and looking ahead, of course, to North by Northwest in that respect, which we'll probably get into as well.
I think that it's funny you mentioned the Statue of Liberty, because I think this is one of those Hitchcock movies like Foreign Correspondent. It's like, it's a movie with like a one-off hero that did one movie with Hitchcock that nobody talks about enough. Like, we did an episode on Foreign Correspondent. I think Foreign Correspondent is a great movie.
Yeah.
And I think Saboteur is great in the same way. It's like, it's a lot of fun. I mean, yeah, it's got the Hitchcock Wrong Man. It's the 39 Steps and literally the movie The Wrong Man, which we've done already, and North by Northwest. And it's funny you said that about the Statue of Liberty. Like, everybody knows Fry hang from the Statue of Liberty, and everybody knows that bit, but there's so many other great bits in this. Like, for I'll start with this one. For reasons I can't even articulate, I think that that black smoke in the beginning that comes across the screen is like the most demonic, creepy, yeah, like unsettling. It's like out of a nightmare, right?
Right.
I think that's great. I think the baby throwing the letters at Tobin's ranch is great.
Yeah, yeah.
The fire extinguisher, I made a list. The maid with the gun, the surprise when he jumps off the bridge, the whole bit with the movie theater, the phone in Soda City. Let's even the name Soda City is great, right? When Barry's speech is like, you know, we will win, we will win. The cross swords, I mean, here's what I would, so I think all those things are great. And it reminded me of, I always use the Howard Hawks test. Do you ever hear the Howard Hawks test for a movie?
Three great scenes, no bad scenes.
Yeah, three great scenes and no bad scenes. Now, this movie does not qualify, though, as a Howard Hawks great movie because of the circus train, which is just like an absolute like dead end, like showstopper in the worst way, that it stops everything.
You know, it's like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where, you know, Pee-wee takes off. He meets an ex-con who was in the joint because he tore the tag off a mattress. It's a do not remove on the penalty of law. He gets in the circus. He's, you know, he has an adventure. He goes to the big dinosaur park that's out in the West. It was like that kind of thing. I don't know where that came from, the freak show, but it fits a pattern in this movie, which is for some reason, everybody helps out Barry Kane at every possible point, and the police are like, you know, it's like the Kids in the Hall sketch where they're like, did you kill that guy? And they keep turning the heat up on the guy, but it's like more ridiculous stuff that they do. Like, they keep not closing in on him. And like everybody, like the Cagney-esque truck driver, the family, the girl, right? The professor himself, who, it's a universal movie. That guy wandered in from The Bride of Frankenstein, right? He's the blind guy living by himself. Like, oh, all my life I've longed for a friend.
Yeah. And he's like, and of course he's like, of course he knows everything. Like, I glasses on now and I can barely see what's going on in front of me. But of course, you know, that's a great movie trope, right? Only the truly blind can see. But it is very much like what you said before about how it just has to make emotional sense, because that's like the whole, like in the 39 Steps when, you know, Robert De Niro is handcuffed to her and they're going across the moors in Scotland and things. And of course, you know, even more, I mean, this movie has like Vulcan-like logic compared to North by Northwest.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's what's interesting about it, is like, it's made for a more naive audience, like for like pre-war audience,
yeah,
right? It's pitched at that intellectual level, but it's as bizarre as North by Northwest, where North by Northwest, I feel like even back then, people were supposed to get like, this is a little bit arch, like we're being nudged in the ribs about this movie.
Right.
Where this one doesn't, right? Because it's full of like these super patriotic speeches, which are all like beautifully inspecific. There's the word Nazi is never mentioned in this movie.
Right.
It's not clear that they're Germans. When the two goons are driving along, they're singing Tonight We Love, which is based on a Tchaikovsky theme. That's what I mean. I think this was like in that three-day period where it wasn't clear, like, who are our wartime enemies going to line up? We know it's Japan, but, you know, for all we know, it could be the Russians, right? They're never up to any good. Right. And I think that's what it is. You will not find any specific thing. Like, you know, Fry may be a German name, but who knows? Right.
Yeah.
I should say, whatever I say, and I'm making fun of this movie famously ends with Fry falling from, you know, the camera pointing straight down and the guy looking like, ah, he, you know, gets smaller and smaller in the frame. And any movie like that, I'm for. Welcome to part two, where we talk about a key scene in the movie. Dan, what is it for you?
So mine is when they're at the dance and you find that everybody's in on it. everybody in the world is in on this conspiracy and he can't leave the room. So he fakes the auction, which is funny because as in North by Northwest, it's another movie where the hero does a fake auction to kind of get out of trouble. Try to buy time. And I think what's great about that is like, it's a moment of dread that reminded me of the end of Rosemary's Baby when she realized like everybody's a Satanist.
Everybody's
in on it. Right. And I think that this movie is great because not only does it give you that feeling of dread in the middle of all these like comically like wacky things, with the billboards, like making little comments about his adventures. I think that's great. And I love Otto Kruger as the perfect villain. I mean, he is great. He is so good as the vague German who's like got these plans to like blow up, you know, the Brooklyn neighborhood.
He's the champagne villain, right? In the Spielberg mode, there has to be a champagne villain, a thug villain, and like a creepy, sexually ambiguous villain.
Yeah, he's totally the champagne villain, right? Totally, right? He's the guy at the Overlook Hotel who says, "Swell party, isn't it?" Like,
yeah. And, you know, and the thing with the granddaughter was like, that was out of left field. It's like, that's like a very modern effect, right? Where you see the super criminal, but somehow he's got a family and he loves his family like everybody else. Yeah.
Well, what that reminded me of was another super criminal in a movie that I know you've seen of is that he reminded me so much of probably my favorite terrible, awful human being in movies. That, like, I think the best villain in movies, who is Noah Cross in Chinatown.
Oh, yeah.
He's just like Noah Cross in Chinatown, right? So like, who has a obviously different family structure than Otto Kruger does here. But I mean, I love him because he's dismissive of the hero. And even as like hard as Jack Nicholson is in Chinatown, like he's still trying to like do the right thing. And then he's like, you know, he's like, remember he says to John Huston, you have all the money. Like, you can't even begin to spend it. Like, what do you want? And he's like, the future, Mr. Gitz, the future, right? And that's so awful and great at the same time. And it reminded me, I thought of that because Charles Tobin, the character says, I just want to read this to you. He says, like, you know, you're one of the ardent believers, a good American. Oh, there's millions like you, people who play along without asking questions. I hate to use the word stupid, but it seems to be the only one that applies. And he calls them like the moron millions. And like Barry Kane is trying to like do the right thing. Like he says, like Charles Tobin says, you're trying to save your country. And he's like, why do you sneer every time you say the country? You've done pretty well here. I don't get it. And it's like the same kind of thing like Jack Nicholson, right? That's why he's such a great villain.
Right. Yeah. And what happens to Tobin and what happens to Freeland? Like they don't get any payoff. And it's like Fry's a bad guy, but he's like very undeveloped, right?
Yeah. Well, Fry's like, he is the thug, like the Spielberg thug villain, right? He's there that actually has to go put the bomb in places.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your moment?
On the end of Fry, I want to get before we, I thought that gimmick had been pioneered by the Coen brothers and the Hudsucker Proxy. I got you by your pants. And the seam is ripping. But of course, anytime you think you saw something for the first time in a movie, somebody did it inside. I'll bet you Hitchcock was the third person to do
that. The seams?
Yeah. Anyway, my key scene is the freak's vote.
Really? Oh.
Just in terms of like encapsulating what's interesting about this movie, which is like, for some reason, they're all like, yeah, he's wanted by the law for blowing up a defense plant, getting people killed. He's serving the enemies of our nation. But, you know, I like the cut of his jib. And the whole thing was like, I mean, it was just so odd. Like they get reminiscent about, you know, what a great guy he is. And then they say, but, you know, it's not just him. It's the woman who's been with them all the way. And like he just kidnapped her 8 hours prior or something like that. And it's got this like 3 days of the Condor transition where she goes from being kidnapped to being in love with him in no time flat.
Well, you're a better man than I, because when the bearded lady was there with her curlers and her beard, I'm like, how did the guy who had such artistic sensibility like Hitchcock think, yeah, this belongs in this movie? Welcome back. In part three, we always talk about the title or the ending. Tim, go.
Well, of course, saboteur comes from sabot, which means to throw a shoe into the wrench, into the works. But what I like about the ending of this movie is it takes liberties with New York geography that, like, you'd have to go with like the cowboy way with Kiefer Sutherland or something like that to find a movie that seems to be less in more like in New York, New York, Las Vegas than it is in New York City. Cause like, she's at the top of Rockefeller Center. He's in Mrs. Sutton, like Mrs. Sutton, where'd she come from? Like she's got this mansion, but apparently it's like the original John Jacob Astor mansion. Right. Like it's right on the street front in New York, and I don't know whether is the girl supposed to be in the, above him at Rockefeller Center, or is he down at the bottom? Or and then they all end up back at Rockefeller Center because they have to have a chase through the movie theater, which was great because it's like it's a parody movie, right? It was clearly it's doing that. That was very intentional. That like it's supposed to be a dramatic movie, and yet the audience is laughing at it.
It was. It reminded me also what you just said about how every time you think something's brand new in a movie, someone did it already. So I remember seeing Inglourious Basterds, and everyone's like, "Oh yeah, that scene in the movie theater is unbelievable." In the movie theater, but it's like, yeah, that's Saboteur. It's in Saboteur.
Yeah, when De Palma had the baby carriage go down the steps, that was the greatest inspiration of his career.
So what do you make at the very end of the title? You have anything else?
I think it's a terrific, like they end up at the Statue of Liberty because of course we're in,
of course,
New York, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, my thing is that this is, of course, you know, this is the second film that has a great climax at the Statue of Liberty. And I know, you know, the other one,
Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins.
No, a movie you've seen even more times than Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins. I'll give you a hint. You maniacs.
Oh, yeah.
You finally did it, didn't you? Damn you all to hell.
You know, I just love the idea that like somehow New Jersey is going to have grown these spectacular California-esque cliffs and in the time that it takes for the apes to take over. That's going to be great.
Well, you'll have to catch up on our episode about Planet of the Apes where we explain exactly how those geographical things happen. But I love how this one, you know, of course, in both movies, you know, that is, you could not get more symbolic weight out of the Statue of Liberty and, you know, what it's there for. Like, you know, in this one, in Planet of the Apes, were the maniacs that blew it up. But in Saboteur, of course, you're trying to stop the other maniacs from blowing it up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, Hitch did his part, right? When the war broke out, I believe actually he was already in Hollywood when England declared war, and he went back to England for a brief period of time because he didn't want to. Yeah, I could be wrong about that, but I believe he was, you like, he's on the right side pretty consistently.
Right.
Yeah.
And we do know that if this movie were remade with Tom Cruise as Barry, he would do all his own stunts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, he'd be right there.
Hanging from the torch. So thanks for listening to our conversation about Saboteur, everyone. You could follow us on X at 15MINFilm. You could let us know what movies to watch next. You can email us at 15minutefilm@gmail.com. See you next time.